Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Hugo Pinksterboer. Hugo, welcome to the show.
I'm very glad to be here.
So you are the author of The Cymbal Book, which for me was like the very first thing I really looked at when I wanted to even think about starting this podcast about 2 years ago. It is just an unbelievable resource for people who are interested in cymbals.
I'm glad it still is. When I started writing the book, there was one thing that I had in my mind, that nobody else should be able to improve on the book right away.
Yeah.
Like, here's a book on cymbals. I can do better than that, you know? So if you write the book, it should be the book and it should be good, because, you know, I'm used to when I do something, I do something like to the max.
Yeah,
and if,
sure.
If you don't, then you'd better not do it. And that goes for writing as well as for drumming, or perhaps even playing the violin.
Yeah, and so we kind of talked to a little bit kind of in preparation for this about, you know, there's almost too much information for it to be translated into a, you know, an episode about the knowledge about cymbals. So I think we're going to kind of come at this from a how the book came to be, how you gathered this information, and we'll bring some tips and tricks out along the way. But it really, I mean, how do you describe the book to someone who's never even heard of it? Do you call it like a handbook or a resource or just a history book? How do you describe it?
It is just everything you'd like to know about cymbals and probably a bit more. I'm absolutely sure that there's tons of drummers who will never read this book because it's just too much information.
Yeah.
And it's really, you need to be truly interested in the subject.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you don't need to read the entire book. And perhaps if you read the chapter that you're interested in, like a chapter on cymbal acoustics, why does a cymbal sound the way it sounds, or a chapter on how you can influence the sound of a cymbal, or the chapter on setups and different ways to think about that, or, well, any of the other chapters, then perhaps when reading it, you might become interested in the other chapters as well.
Yeah, that's a great point of how it's broken up, where I like it because I actually did it where through a library, I kind of got, you know, a digital version of it. Because for me, it was like midnight and I was working on this Zildjian thing and I was like just trying to put all this stuff together. And you're by chapter. So there's like there's chapters like the companies, historical dates. There's all sorts of things about cymbal care. And like you said, there's like the technical stuff, like why they sound like that. So you've got a lot of like company names that, and I've been, you know, really looking and researching a lot of stuff for the show. And there's multiple brands that you have that I've never heard of. Let's go to the first kind of broad discussion of how did you put this thing together?
the thing is, I was working as a journalist for Slugware Krant, and probably a lot of American drummers know the magazine, the Dutch Modern Drummer, say, because they were interviewed by the people from Slugware Krant. And Slugware Krant, which means basically drummer's journal, organized lots of festivals in the Netherlands with numerous guests from Simon Phillips and Steve Smith to Trilo Kurtu, Terry Bozio, and all these other guys. So I worked for that magazine, and I did all of the jazz interviews and some of the other interviews as well. And I was responsible for all the instrument reviews, including cymbals.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in the subject, and as I said about the book, if you do something, you have to do it, you know, to the max. So when I started doing drum set reviews, I started reading, you know, modern drummer reviews and Rhythm, I think back then, and all of the drummers magazines. The internet was not really there back then. You know, we're talking about 1985 or so. So I started reading that, but I also started working one night a week in a little drum store where I did drum set repairs, because I felt that that would make me understand more of the construction of the instrument and questions that people have and the things they break and why they break, etc., etc. So I found out, for instance, that these early, I don't know if they still do that, but the early low-budget drum sets always came with, you know, a few extra lug inserts. And that seems like a nice gesture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But they do that just because these things always break down. You know, you strip the thread and then they're gone.
So yeah.
It's not a nice gesture. It's just a necessity. Anyways, so I started doing that. I started doing drum set reviews and cymbal reviews and sticks and what have you. And I found cymbals unbelievably fascinating, more so than drums. Mm. That was one thing. The other thing was that you know, I did all of these interviews with my heroes, including the man who inspired me to play jazz, Art Blakey.
Oh wow!
And that was one of the most memorable events of my life. Probably I heard one of his records when I was 16 or so, and that turned me into playing jazz. Mm. Then years later, I found out that the man was just alive, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And that he was actually playing in Holland, and 2, 3, 4 years later, I joined him for a conversation, and it was kind of a hilarious conversation because he was quite deaf by that time. And so he told a story about how friends of his had bought him a new drum set, and that they asked him to come down into the garden, and they had put his old drum set on fire, and there was this new drum set, something like that. And I said, "Well, that must have been a nice surprise." He said, "What?" I said, "That must have been a nice surprise." And he said, "What?" But then he didn't remember what he had been telling. So, you know.
Oh, man.
He was really old at that time.
Oh, of course. And yeah.
Still
yeah.
Playing his ass off. I mean, I'm sure. Telling you this story, but it's with the utmost respect.
Yes. It's just a funny story.
Yeah. Anyways, so, and I met, you know, Steve Smith and Arthur Taylor, one of my heroes, and Jack DeJohnette, and all these people. And there was somehow a desire in me to do something internationally, so I would not be just, you know, the guy who interviewed them for this Dutch Drummers magazine, but, you know, to get out of this little country and do something worldwide. And it was not that I thought of writing the cymbal book because I wanted to go, you know, international, but it was just, I found out there was not a book on cymbals. And I thought, well, that's up to me. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I talked about that. And then I was in touch with Colin Schofield because I used to go to all these music conventions. I was in touch with Colin Schofield, who back then worked for Zildjian. And I told him about this plan. And he said, well, then you need to come down to Zildjian. And I said, well, I don't have a budget, you know. I'm a part-time civil servant, and I'm a part-time drummer, and I'm a part-time drum tech, and I'm a part-time whatever. And he said, no problem. We'll get you there.
Oh, cool.
So the idea was that Zildjian would get me to Boston, and then I would write an article on Zildjian. But of course, you know, being a vocational guidance counselor by origin, it was not supposed, of course, to be a Zildjian book or a book about the opinion of Hugo Pinksterboer on cymbals or whatever. It should be a book that provides information that allows you to make your own choices. So when they had offered me this, I went to Sabian and I said, listen, I'm going to Zildjian. Under those conditions, can I come to you guys too? And I went then to Paisti and UFIB and Istanbul and Minol. That was it, I think. the main companies at that time, and they all said, okay, so they all got their article and they all paid the for the trip and the hotel and what have you.
That's so awesome. I never would have thought about it. That's just cool to know that little bit about it. I mean, it's not like they're paying to have like a slot in the book, but they're just kind of basically saying like, yeah, we want to be a part of it and we understand that you're doing this. We'll help you get there.
Yeah, right. You know? Because of course it's important to the entire industry that a book like that, you know, is there. Because I'm really convinced, and I wrote a series of books later on called the Tip Book Series, much less in depth. Like the single book is, as I just said, a book for drummers who really want to know everything about this fascinating instrument. Yeah. The other books that I wrote are just like, you should really know this about your instrument. Mm-hmm. But it's basically the same approach. You know, why does one guitar cost like $500 and the other one $50 or $5,000?
Yeah, sure.
How do the different materials that are being used for a guitar influence the sound? How does the shape of the resonator influence the sound? How does the profile of the neck influence the playability and the shape and the size of the frets? And the same for saxophones and clarinet. And I probably can safely say that I'm the only drummer who ever wrote a book about violins and clarinet and flutes. In Tip Book Drums, this is the Tip Book series. In Tip Book Drums, the chapter on cymbals is about, 10 pages or so.
Yeah.
And the cymbal book is just looking at 210 pages. So that's kind of a big difference.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But you do have the thing. I like just kind of looking through it here a little bit. I like that it's just very practical as well. Like mounting, like section 7.1.2. It's like angle of your hi-hat. The angle of the bottom cymbal is usually adjustable by a tilting mechanism. It's just like, and then you have a whole description there. It's if the gap is too small, it will limit maximum volume. It's like, it tells you things that you kind of figure out on your own, but you just know that. So carry on here. So you had just gone to all of the cymbal companies, which really, as we know, that's only a portion of this. That's not by any means, it's not the history of Zildjian, Meinl, Sabian, and Paiste. It's so much more than that. How did the rest of it come together?
Of course, the visits to these companies taught me a lot more than just the manufacturing process.
Yeah.
Speaking about that, you know, I would go to say that the entire process consists of five different steps. Then the first company would say, well, we're not going to show you step two because that's really, you know, we don't tell people how we do that. When I went to these other companies and they said, well, we're going to show you step one and two, we won't show you step three. So, you know, at one point you can just fill in the blanks. And of course, I found out things just by combining bits and pieces of information. I found out things that I was not supposed to share in the book, and I didn't share them because, you know, that's not the purpose of the book.
Yeah, no.
It was kind of fun, you know. They would say we're not going to tell you, and I said, well, okay, you don't need to, you know.
Yeah,
because I already know. so that's about the production. But they also, of course, told me about the history of the company, the history of the manufacturing process that they use, but also about cymbal acoustics and about testing cymbals and assessing their sound. And you know, I was talking to the cymbal experts of the world, and that taught me a lot.
Oh my God, I'm sure. Now, let's pause and just say that this book was written and came out in the early 90s, correct?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's going on 30 years old.
It's fun, you know. I'm really happy that it's still selling, you know, the 30-year-old book, which is in itself, you know, like really special.
Yeah.
I think what still makes it a valuable book is that, of course, I mean, lots of things have changed in the sense that when I went to Istanbul, there was just one company, Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And later on split up and when it became Istanbul Agop and Istanbul Mehmet.
Yep.
And then under Istanbul Mehmet, you had Istanbul Mehmet and Turkish symbols. And then some people wanted to split and they started their own company. And then now you have like a zillion Turkish companies.
Yeah.
And brands. And there's loads of people who started making symbols. I mean, and you have the symbols with the holes and the symbols, the spiral symbols and what have you, and new brands and new models. And everybody is making like tons of series.
Yeah.
Which makes it like a very, which makes choosing symbols even harder than it used to be.
Sure.
But the basics, I mean, it's a bronze disc with a hole in the middle. And the basics of symbol acoustics and the basics on manufacturing processes and the basics of everything that you read in the book are still the same. And the same goes for, you know, the books that I did on acoustic and electric guitars or violins or saxophones or whatever. I mean, the symbol is an instrument that goes back to the days of the Bible and before. And modern day symbol, as everyone knows, goes back to Zildjian in 1623.
It's hard to have an episode, and I've done them with Istanbul Agop and Sabian. Obviously, Sabian's a special circumstance with the Zildjian thing, but where you can't really talk about a symbol book and companies and symbol anything without talking about Zildjian.
Yeah.
For that reason, if it goes back to the 1623 and the special, you know, alloy and all that. But one thing that I'm actually working on doing right now is more of the, you know, I want to do Paiste, obviously, but I'm trying to get UFIP as well because they have that different system, the kind of spun system, and just learn more about those, like the Italian side of things. Mm-hmm. So did you go to UFIP or did you just piece that together from a different source?
No, UFIP. I went there too. It was beautiful. You know, I was picked up at the airport by Luigi Tronchi. I think he's still involved with the company.
Yeah, I think so.
He picked me up and we went out to have dinner first.
Wow.
And work is like the next day. While in Germany, you come into the company. I went there by car, you know, it's like a 6-hour drive or so. And they basically said back then, how was your trip? Would you like something to drink? And what's your first question? I mean,
there's no dinner. There's no romance.
It is like that. It's like, and these countries are, you know, you go from Meinl to UFIP in maybe a 12-hour drive or so. They're neighbors, you know, but cultures are way, way, way different.
Yeah, so, that is just so different from, and you know, just being in America here, it would obviously be, it's a different story driving from, I feel like you drive from one, you know, New York to California and it's still relatively pretty much the same thing. But you, I mean, they're obviously, you're going to different countries. They're different complete histories and cultures. And I did an interview with Andy Zildjian and he talked a little bit about how Sabian, or I believe it was Zildjian, and then Sabian owned the Tosco. How Sabian owned the Tosco factory, and they, it was just so laid back, and there was different, you know, books depending, like you know, the finances depending on who wanted to read it. It was just
like bookkeeping and things. I mean, tricky things have changed, of course, too.
Yeah,
but I remember going there in the. That was like probably in the mid 80s or so, late 80s that I started working on the book. And we were in the car and they would say, Hugo, how much was ticket? I said, how much was ticket? I think 400, you know, or so.
Yeah.
So his hand goes into his chest pocket, comes out with a handful of bills. And while driving, you know, he hands me the money. And I said, don't you need a receipt or so? He said, no, not necessary. We put in book.
Yeah. And there's no like invoice. There's
that was it. I mean,
that's funny.
Culturally, that's so completely different, you know?
Yeah.
I met all of these people, and I'd like to tell something about that too.
Sure.
But there was, well, let's say that the Zildjian people and the Sabian people were not the best of friends.
No.
There was really, really, really a big problem. And of course, the two main characters out of that story are no longer among us, mm-hmm. Armin and Robert. But it would be really hard to find two people as different, you know, as these two brothers.
Yeah.
The same, incidentally, was true for Robert and Thomas Paiste. And they were way different from each other also, but they didn't split up, of course.
Yeah.
What always struck me is that you had one guy who was in the case of Paiste, Thomas Paiste was the bon vivant and the businessman, throwing parties and, you know, having lots of fun. And Robert Paiste was very much into himself and not really easy to get to. And he wrote poems in his spare time, and he was the sound designer.
Oh, wow.
And then that was in the Swiss village of Notwil. And then in the United States, you had in the city of Norwell, which is, mm-hmm. that sounds pretty much the same. You had these two other brothers where Armand was the bon vivant, you know, and into the symbols. And his brother, Robert, was like the businessman.
Yeah.
And Robert was absolutely not happy with the fact that I was writing a book on symbols.
Really? Why not?
He basically said, and you're a journalist and you're going to destroy everything and you're going to talk about everything that we don't want you to know, and you're going to spread all kind of information. And so he was actually really against it. But luckily, I was good friends with Wayne Blanchard.
But you're very respectful of everything. And like you said, it's a unbiased, there's not an opinion, there's not really much in the book where you say, this is what you're going to want to use. Like, cool. You like this. But on that note, what is your personal preference? Like, are you a Zildjian guy? Are you a Paiste guy? Or what do you like?
Basically, old K Zildjians.
Okay.
And there's a 22, an 18, and a pair of hi-hats. The hi-hat is pictured in the book, the top symbol. And if you put a top symbol on a table and you put the clutch in, then the clutch is supposed to make like a 90-degree angle with the table.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is an old K, and it leans to the right. Uh-huh. You don't have to look closely to see that.
It's just doing
circles. The lathing grooves around the cup.
Yeah,
they're at the groove that's at the bottom of the cup on one side goes sort of halfway over the cup on the other side, and the top symbol is just a bit smaller than the other one. And of course, all of these symbols are self tilting.
You know, yeah,
the hole is never in the middle, and what have you. And the fun thing is, I took these old hi-hats. Tal Bergman was at my place for a couple of days once, and he played those hi-hats, and I said, Tal, I have to get some groceries or whatever. I came back 15 minutes later, and he was still playing those hi-hats, you know?
Man.
He really loved them. So I took these symbols with me when I went to Turkey, one of my visits to Istanbul, and I said to Mehmet, can you make these symbols? And they started, you know, trying to mimic these symbols, and they were a nice pair of hi-hats, but they didn't come close. The thing is that some of the factory workers had those symbols of me in their hands. They said, you want us to throw them out? Throw them out? Why? It's bozuk, or it's rubbish.
Oh.
And they didn't have any appreciation for the fact that these were like among the most sought after hi-hat symbols, you know?
Yeah.
True, old, K, crooked, warped, what have you, you know?
And so the old Ks were those the ones that were then? Those old Ks would have been made in Turkey.
In Turkey.
With that?
Yeah.
And I heard something, and you would, I mean, again, look at who I'm talking to, obviously. But so I heard something about how in the old K factory, there would be something where they would try, and I guess there was maybe a stack of symbols, and they would shape multiple of them at one time, and the ones that were lower in the stack didn't get quite shaped as well. And those were the ones that got sent to America, and the ones that were like the more crisp top symbols would stay either in Turkey or elsewhere. And the whatever it was that wasn't quite as, you know, sharp and clean as the rest of them is what became exactly what you're talking about. And obviously yours wouldn't have been in America. So as I'm saying that, I'm like, well, you probably got one of the different ones, but they left Turkey and they weren't like, it was like a different.
I never heard that. I mean, you have so many conspiracy theories today.
Yeah.
I never heard that story. And
that might've been Andy Zildjian who said that. I can't remember. I got to listen. I'm getting it all mixed up now, but
he wasn't there. And what
I've
seen, in Turkey and how things go there, they didn't even take, you know, they didn't go through a process. I can't imagine that they did things like that because they just make symbols.
Yeah, sure.
And nobody is going to select, well, this one is a little bit better, so we'll send that too. They just did it the way they did it as craftsmen, you know?
Yeah.
And what I heard about the stack of symbols is that they, to shape the cup, they didn't have a hydraulic press as they do today. So you would have like a steel table, like an anvil with a hollow, which was like the shape of the cup to be. And then say maybe 2, 3, 4, I don't know, symbols were put on top of that table, and a concave, is that? They would take a large hammer and hit on it a few times.
Yeah.
So that, of course, the cup of the lowest symbol would have a different shape than the cup of the symbol of the higher symbols.
Yes, that's exactly what I was. Yeah.
And of course, these cups wouldn't be like perfectly aligned in any sense.
Yeah.
And then they would drill the holes. Well, exactly what I just described about the top of the hi-hat symbols. I mean,
yeah,
it goes all over the place. But that sound is unimitable. I mean, it's a truly unique sound. And I still feel that. And of course, Zildjian makes these beautiful Constantinople symbols, and everybody's making those kind of symbols. And I think the only way you can truly replicate the old K Zildjian sound is to make symbols that are not perfectly aligned in any sense.
Yeah.
But then who's going to do that? Because you're very well aware that probably, I don't know, 60%, 40%, 80% of what you make, you know, can be thrown out. So it would make them really expensive. But this is just a wild guess.
You
know, a long time ago wrote a book on symbols.
Yeah. Well, all right. So back to the book here. So you did the brands, there's all that stuff, but I just really think it's valuable and cool that you have the information on, like, it's great to learn about all that stuff, but it's also got very practical information about, like, symbol care, about cleaning your symbols, which, I mean, I, when I was a kid, bought some, I forget what it was, like a little, like goldish, like, tin of some stuff, and I was too young, and I was, like, trying to clean, like, I had like an A medium ride, like just a standard like Avidus medium ride. And I remember trying to clean it. And I think I was just too young and I didn't know what I was doing. But since then, I've never cleaned my cymbals ever. And I've heard the debate about it's good to clean them. You know, people will clean them every day. And then I've heard also, you know, you get a certain sound if you never clean them. So what's your take on cleaning cymbals?
I don't write about music anymore, not really. I write on motorcycles now. I'm the editor-in-chief of an organization, a motorcyclist action group.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's really cool. And it's like writing about drum sets or guitars, but now they have two wheels. And well, just one look at my motorcycle will tell you all about my cymbal cleaning. I never clean them. You're not going to clean old K Zildjians.
No, exactly. Okay.
The hi-hats actually were buffed at one time by someone who didn't know what he was doing, obviously. I don't mind because I like the way the really off way they sound. I don't clean them, and I don't clean the other symbols as well. I use and that's one of my big loves, a 22-inch Pang, a Zildjian.
Yeah, sure.
I have a great, extremely low sounding 16-inch new K Zildjian Crash. And I have quite some symbols from the Istanbul factories, like Turkish symbols and Istanbul. Just like a few weird ride symbols. And when Turkish symbols started, you know, coming off the Istanbul Mehmet company, mm-hmm. I said, you really need to make some symbols that are different from what the others do. While sticking to the four main series that you should make, in my point of view, and sure. I asked them to make me a really thin unlathed ride cymbal, and they did, and it was a 22 that weighed about as much as a regular lathe 20, so it's very very flexible, and then they made me an 18 like that as well, and it just it's like a very different sound concept. And I sometimes like to play those, you know.
Yeah,
it goes up and down.
Variety
and cleaning. I totally accept that and appreciate the fact that people love to play clean and shining cymbals. And I also totally appreciate the fact that there are people who don't. I don't.
That just you saying that that's the beauty of the drums is you can see someone who likes to have their tom perfectly flat. Someone who likes to have their tom completely, you know, tilted forward and everywhere in between, mm-hmm. like your cymbals are, it's just, we, you know, it's a way to express ourselves or, you know, clean yeah. off, take off the labels like certain drummers and stuff.
It's like tuning your 12 inch tom tom might sound way lower than my 14 inch roar.
Exactly.
Around or whatever. And I'd love to experiment with that. And, at one point I played with a very, well, no, like a bebop tune, 18-inch drum, an extremely high 10, and a 16-inch floor tom that was tuned as low as it gets. And
okay.
that yeah. inspires me, basically, to do other things, you know? You can do whatever you want with a drum set.
Yeah.
We're free spirits in the musician's world, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. No one tells us what to do. You tell me to clean my cymbal, I'm not going to clean it. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. You also have a danger. I like that you also say the danger of, it's just like, when you look at this book, there's just basically everything kind of gets answered where you talk about how like there's almost like a protective film on newer cymbals that you don't want to use these things on the cleaner on because it could go away. So and then auto polishing compound ketchup leaves a residue and doesn't like that's just so.
Yes, I remember that one.
Did you experiment with this stuff? Were you out there with like ketchup on your cymbals or a cymbal, I should say? Or is this just word of mouth?
That was probably word of mouth. And it was literally word of mouth because internet was not really happening, you know, in the late 80s.
No,
I don't even remember when I had my first internet connection. But it was, I mean, this book, the layout was done, you know, just, you know, sticking pieces of paper to another piece of paper. It was like with scissors and glue.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've heard that with Not So Modern Drummer, you know, famous publication. John Aldridge was on the show talking about that.
Aldridge, yeah.
Yeah, cutting things out and they're printing it and wherever they can get a printer. And So then let me also ask you here, one thing that I think is really interesting is the segment on cracked and broken symbols. Mm-hmm. Because this is something that I've never, I think I drilled out one symbol. I had an A custom that had a crack and I drilled it out to stop the crack. But again, I feel like I'm not a very handy person, or I feel like I'm more like, I don't know, like not, like I do more damage. Again, similar. So I am also, I like motorcycles as well. Mm-hmm. I've done it, but I'm on the other end where I've done it where I've, you know, I'm going to put some air in my tire and I put too much air in and it somehow caught a nail on the actual, like the wheel hub and popped the tube and I had to get an all new everything. So it was So, yeah, been burned. Now what's just kind of go tell us a little bit about broken cymbals. Cause there's the drilling them, there's cracks on the edge, there's cutting it off. Like if I have a broken cymbal, can I make it sound good still?
Yeah, it depends on your definition of good sound.
Good answer.
I'm boring. I'm just giving all of these answers, you know, that you can't do anything with, or you can use it and do as
yeah.
with it as you can. Seriously, I know a guy in Holland who would just like turn 16-inch cymbals with a correct edge. He would turn them into 14-inch cymbals, and they would, of course, be more of a bell type cymbal.
Sure.
After that, because the shape, the bow relative to the size is different, but also yeah. the cymbal is thickest at and around the cup, and then it mm-hmm. thinner towards the edges. And if you remove these thin edges, then the cymbal won't respond as fast.
Yeah.
So, you can either throw it out or do something radical with it. I remember that in the workshop where I used to do these little repairs, and it's by no means professional what I did there, but it was just, you know, I would do things and learn things from it. There was a Costco that had a crack that came from the outside and went in like maybe an inch or so. And there was maybe two smaller cracks in that same area. So there's actually a photo of that symbol in the book. So there was like a very broad V shape that I cut out of the edge.
Yeah, I see it.
Then I took four rivets and I mounted two rivets on each side, because that was, of course, the lighter side of the symbol, because there was just a section missing there. So
yeah.
The symbol would tilt itself, you know, towards the place where the rivets were not, because they would be at the light side. And I've used that symbol a lot. And of course, being a right symbol, it wouldn't crack that much. The risk of it cracking more than it was. I mean, I never cracked symbols. I was a very bad customer for the stick industry as well, because I actually love sticks where the wood tips sort of splinter away so that you get this bit of softer sound.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not in the stick breaking or in the cymbal breaking area.
No, but if you do, which, you know, in your lifetime of drumming, it's bound to happen at least once with maybe a crash or something, or thicker cymbals I know do too. But I want to mention too that you have a little bit here, like an image, or I guess you'd call it like a figure on the page that's two symbols where it says you don't, if you do cut it out, like, you know, trim out if a chunk comes off, you don't cut it at a point because that creates further cracking.
Yeah, which actually you're looking at page 106 now, not because I remember the book by heart, but I just looked at the section.
I'm on 106. Yeah.
106. There's the Tosco symbol with the wide V shape. Cut. If you cut out a cymbal and you make sharp edges in the cymbal, so you don't cut out a wide V shape, or you or say so you should avoid in that V shape that it actually has the point where the two legs of the V come together. Mm-hmm. That should be a smooth corner, if you will. I mean.
Yeah.
If you have sharp edges, the symbol will absolutely start cracking there.
Can I? All right. So, and this is, I think I would know the answer maybe, but can you answer why do symbols crack? What is the reason that they crack? What is a symbol that's more prone to crack? You know, just in theory, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think symbols crack because they're not being played correctly.
If you too hard or
too hard, sticks that are too heavy, or drummers that put a lot of stress on the edge of the cymbal. Drummers should watch these beautiful videos on YouTube, and where you look for high speed camera used on a
cymbal, yeah,
or a drum head.
Yeah, it's all wobbly and
it's really if you hit the cymbal, you can see that it vibrates. If you want to really see how it vibrates, then look at one of these little YouTube videos. And if you understand a bit about, you know, what a cymbal is, if you put it on, if you mount your cymbals horizontally and you hit them with your stick under a 90 degree angle, then all of the energy goes into that edge, you know, and it has to go somewhere, and it cannot give, because the edge, if you hit it on this straight angle, it has no place to go. So it will probably give up. I mean, Simon Phillips is somebody who can, you know, you never hear people complain about that Simon is playing too softly. He can, of course, but he can really smack those cymbals. He used pretty thin cymbals. He never cracked cymbals because it's the glancing motion.
Yeah, it lets the cymbal breathe, I guess, or lets the energy. It's like, I guess it's like the energy has to go somewhere, and if you don't let the energy go somewhere, it's gonna break.
Yeah, it's gonna give up. Yeah.
Now I've had some old, super thick Z custom cymbals, which I'm 99% sure they don't even make Z's anymore. Mm-hmm. And those I had more, I think I had, so I had a crash, it was like a 19 inch crash or something where it just split. And I was younger and probably not really, I was probably hitting too hard and doing different stuff wrong, but like, is a thicker cymbal more prone to crack than a, like, I just feel like I had more trouble with Z's. And I saw more people say Z's would crack, but I might have just had a bum cymbal or something.
Maybe the answer is in the book. I wouldn't know at this moment. But it's you maybe if you would compare it to if you have a glass and you drop it, it'll break. You know, it's very stiff and heavy. If you have a piece of paper and you drop it, nothing will happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's
wow.
It's like,
yeah,
it can wobble, it can move, so the energy has places to go, and these heavier cymbals are restricted in their movement.
Yeah.
So perhaps I'm not completely sure about that. It is, you really need just to take some loving care of the instrument, and that also means that you don't tighten them up.
Sure.
Because then again, if you mount them really tight, the energy cannot go places, so you'll crack. If you don't use cymbal sleeves, then you hurt the cymbal from the inside out. There's this picture of the cymbal with a keyhole in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can by now safely say that I made that keyhole myself, not because I didn't have these rubber things on my cymbal stands, but I was at this drum shop, you know, where I used to do these repairs, and I was looking for cracked cymbals to make photos of for the book, And I'm looking for a symbol with a keyhole to make a photograph. And I've seen many symbols with a keyhole in that drum store in my, you know, in the years that I was working there. There wasn't any symbol with a keyhole inside. So I took lithograph symbols and I got myself a file and I hand filed the keyhole into the symbol.
It's a fake keyhole. It's a hoax.
The whole book is fake, actually.
It's all fake.
It doesn't even exist. Yeah.
That's funny. And so people know, maybe if you're out there and you've never experienced a keyhole, like Hugo was saying, a keyhole is where you've got your symbol, and then in the bell where you actually slide the symbol stand, the hole, you have metal touching metal. And as you progressively play more, it literally just kind of makes like a nodule, which you can see if you get the book on page 95, you can see Hugo's lie of a symbol that isn't really a key. No, I'm kidding. But it's very common. One problem I have sometimes with like sleeves is I'll have like the sleeve. I'm talking probably on cheapo stands because I truly have never, ever actually invested in like a nice DW or whatever brand symbol stand. I always bought the cheapo ones, which served me fine. But
me too.
The sleeve will be very high up on the threading of the, you know, arm where the symbol stand, the actual, you know, where the symbol sits. So I can never get enough tension down on the symbol to get, you know, some control. Now I do, that's maybe on one or two of my stands, but I feel like that's kind of a common problem where I've even had to take like a knife or like a file and cut off and trim down my sleeve to be able to get a little bit of control.
Okay, well, I never controlled my symbols in that sense anyways. I use the camber T-tops on top, so I don't use wing nuts.
Okay, sure.
They're too time-consuming.
You're a busy man.
Extremely busy. And playing every week. I'm not playing that much. I love the T-tops because you just slide the symbol over them and they're there. And they, you know, the T-top is not to keep the symbol on the stand. The T-top is there to prevent the sleeve from creeping upwards.
Ah, gotcha.
So that works fine for me. And you know, if the sleeve is too long, you just use some extra felt if you want to control the symbol to
and bring it up. And
yeah, and I would definitely suggest to do that with right symbols only.
Yeah,
because crash symbols really should, you know, be able to move. Because if they don't, you crack them. And if you crack the symbol within the limited time warranty, and you take it to the store and it goes to the factory, then the people at the factory can exactly tell you how you played it, how you mounted it. They can read the symbol.
Yeah,
and if they read in the symbol that you mounted it too tightly, then the warranty is off. I mean, it's like motorcycle tires. You give an expert a motorcycle tire, and he can tell you how you ride, you know?
Yeah, you're riding like an idiot. And you didn't. In my case, you're doing something wrong. I recently, they actually gave me one, not, you know, to plug a product here, and that I actually really like. I have a kit here at my house that I have it on. Just, it's like a smaller little set with I just use a ride and a hi-hat on it. And it's called the No Nuts Cymbal Sleeve. And basically, it just slides down and it replaces the whole thing, the whole washer, the sleeve. And I really like it. I always kind of thought I would see people with, I mean, obviously the idea of having a cymbal just on there without anything on the top, people have done that for a long time, but this kind of has like a higher, like sleeve. So it's not going to pop off. The ease of switching cymbals using that system of just, you know, pop it on, pop it off, is great. There's so many different ways to do it. And you got the little clippy ones that are, I don't even know who makes those, where you squeeze it and they clip on. You got guys who use like, you know, dice that are like, you know, looks like they're in Las Vegas, like custom.
Yeah. I've seen those. I still read the Dutch Drummers magazine, of course, you know, because
of course.
Yeah. So I get to see, all of these new things that pass by, and And some of these things are really old things, you know. I remember that I think Yamaha came out with the boom arm, the convertible boom stand, where you can actually hide the boom in the top segment of the cymbal stand.
You can use exactly, yeah.
And as a boom stand, and then I was at the company that back then was the Premier drum distributor for the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And in his showroom was a like early 1930s or so Premier drum set. It had that same convertible boom stand, you know.
Yeah.
So many of these things, they come and they go, and then somebody invents them again, or they think they invent them because they've never seen that. I'm not accusing anyone of copying the stuff, but all the weird things. I just went through the book, of course, this weekend, and I saw that. I remembered. There's a drummer playing for Weather Report, and they were looking for a specific type of sound. And then Joe Zawinul said, "Why don't we try that trash can lid?" Hmm. And it actually sounded great. So they took it to the studio. Joe's wife was a bit pissed, I think, and they drilled a hole in the middle, mounted it on a stand, and it worked great. But then it didn't last that long because the trash went away, as the drummer says it. And Joe Zawinul has had many drummers, so at this point in time, I just don't remember who it is in the book. And then a little American company actually introduced the trash can lid cymbal.
Oh, yeah.
And they had an ad in Monodrummer, and I was like, are you serious? That ad of that company just appeared only once, and then it was gone.
Oh, I see. Okay. So as we get close to time here, I just want to ask you, what are like, obviously, this book came out a long time ago. It does stand like alone as a piece of, you know, a resource. Since then, obviously, some new brands have come out. There's Dream Cymbals, who you were talking about the options. This is just a side note. The options of, you know, cut the cymbal if it's cracked, or drill it, or throw it away. They also do a recycle program where you get $1 per inch.
Yeah.
But what are some, have you seen anything cool that you're like, you know, little cymbal mount stuff that if you were to redo it today that you would want to include in the book?
Well, I mean, I've been into motorcycles for the past 3 years, and then before in all of these other things. So I read it, but my knowledge is much more like a passive than active.
Got it.
I would definitely want to shed light on new developments.
Yeah.
Technically, but then again, you know, the basics are still the basics, and these Constantinople cymbals are really popular. Meinl makes cymbals in that same vein mm-hmm. that are extremely popular. The Turkish people, and they still make these cymbals the same way. So basically, there's nothing really new under the sun.
Yeah.
And many people have requested me, like, why don't you do it again? And I said, well, you know, I don't even know how many copies of the book have been sold in these past 27 years. But I can tell you can't make a living off of it, really.
You're not the first, but Jeff Nichols, who did the drum book, has said, he's like, buy it, don't buy it, I don't care, I don't make money off of it. Buy it secondhand from a thrift store, I don't care.
Yeah. So, the main thing for me, you know, that felt good. Of course, I would be at a NAMM show, you know, 20 years after the book came out, and people would probably notice my name on my, you know, on my little badge, and they said, you go, you do the symbol, hey man, thank you. And that was, you know, and people of these newer Turkish companies, they would say thank you for putting Turkey on the map, you know, as a symbol making country. And you know, it was just, I just helped spread the word, and that, yeah, I was very, I'm just very happy that I was in the position to do that, and to have all these wonderful people helping me with like creating the book and doing lots of work for it, you know, because nowadays you just say, look it up on the web. And then we did all this, my, you know, writing letters and faxes, and I would be on the phone with the United States of America, and then they said, hold the line, and I would sit there. I was like, that is $2.50 per minute. Can you please be quick?
Hurry it up. Yeah, it's different now, man. I mean, like right now, this interview would have cost us like, you know, $50 or $100.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I want to say thank you because, you know, you were an early influence on me for doing history research, which it's like, you're still my go-to book of like, oh, I was going to look up, you know, the history of, like, there's just those little things like the old, like sizzlers where you look back and they were these like, kind of like things that would come off of the top and go down and the arms. And there's so much history to all this. And I also want to mention too, just as a friend, I have a few of the symbols, Ray Byrne symbols. He makes great handmade symbols here. I know Nicky Moon does symbols, which I've never played, but I've heard about him on multiple podcasts. And just so there are people doing it. You know what I mean? It's still evolving. And I think it's really cool that people can get into it. And it's no longer the big four that you mentioned before, you know, Zildjian, Sabian, Paiste, and Meinl. So it's a cool time.
It absolutely is. And one last thing. If you and I still get questions of people who say, do you know who made this symbol? And I hardly ever do. All I can say, if you have a symbol and you have no clue who made it, 99 out of 100 times, it will be UFIB.
Really?
Because UFIB, when I was there, I got a request like that probably a couple of weeks ago, and then a couple of weeks later, the guy sent me, I found out it came out of the UFIB factory, and he included a sheet with stamps, logos, symbol logos, that were sent to him by someone, I don't remember now. And then I remembered that when I was at UFIB, they opened up a drawer, and there were all these metal logo stamps that were used for symbols. They made everything, you know, and often, of course, with a Turkish half moon, or a star, or both, or what have you. They made symbols for everyone. And now, of course, like there's many manufacturers who make sticks for everyone.
Sure.
There's nothing new under the sun.
So they were like the, there's so many words for it, like white label or OEM or stencil. They were just creating,
next to their own symbols. And of course, they gave birth indirectly to the wonderful creations of the late Robert Spitzikino.
Yeah, which someone recently, and I got to look up the, I usually like to give people a shout out. Someone mentioned to do an episode on him, and I wasn't as familiar, and I looked it up and I was like, oh my God, these symbols are like $2,000. Very rare. And I kind of saw a little bit about a brief history, but so that's another one that I got to find the right guy.
There's a Dutch guy, a Dutch drummer who knows, who was involved with Roberto.
Okay. Well, maybe you can send me his info and get us in touch if you think he'd be a good guy on the show. Okay. And then I've had multiple people say you should do a symbol episode, and a few people have said you need to talk to Hugo. So thank you to everyone who did. It was a while ago, so I apologize for not being able to remember. And a thank you to Rob Cook, per usual, for connecting me with you. Rob Cook of the Chicago Drum Show. Gave me your info and your phone number and stuff. So, man, Hugo, this is just, this is one of those bucket list episodes for me that I've, you know, wanted to do for a year and a half now. So it's been awesome having you on the show, and I appreciate you taking the time. And I think, obviously, we've talked about it a lot, so why don't we just tell people where they can get the symbol book? I mean, is it the standard, you know, go ahead and get it on Amazon kind of thing? Is that the best route?
Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if people want, just Google the symbol book and it'll show up. But otherwise, or you can look up Hugo, and it's PinkSterBoer. Check out the symbol book online, and that's great. Hugo, thank you for being on the show, my friend.
Thank you for having me. And I was actually really surprised that we could talk for over an hour.
We made it through
so long ago. And I'm going to read it again and again.
Oh, awesome. Me too. It's always a constant source for me. So cool. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning. This is a Gwyn Sound podcast.